Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We begin today's show with journalist Eyal Press, author of the new book, Dirty Work, Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. He tells the stories of guards who patrol the wards of the country's most violent and abusive prisons, undocumented immigrants who man the kill floors of slaughterhouses, and U.S. drone operators who drop bombs on people in faraway countries 1 minute and pick up their kids from school the next. The common thread among these workers: stigma, shame, PTSD, often physical injury, and suicide. The system allows this to continue with little assistance or recourse for these workers. Eyal Press writes that we are increasingly shielded and distanced from this human suffering and these morally questionable jobs that other less privileged people perform in our name. Eyal Press is an award-winning writer and journalist and a contributor to The New Yorker, The New York Times, and other publications. He's the author of several books. His most recent is Dirty Work, Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. Hi, Eyal. Thank you so much for joining us again. It's been a while.
Thank you so much for having me on the program.
Well, it's great to have you. You did such a great job with this book. It's a very heavy book to read. But as you say, and I think this is so, so important, we have to listen to the stories of these workers, however unsettling what they tell us may be.
Thank you so much for that. And it is a heavy book. But I think it's addressing issues that all of us care about and need to grapple with. And let me just say a little bit about what led me to write the book the way I did. Because as you mentioned in your opening, there are sections of the book on people who work in industrial slaughterhouses, mainly in undocumented immigrants. There are sections of the book set behind the walls of prisons. There are sections of the book that take place on drone bases, where sensor operators and imagery analysts conduct drone strikes. And a one common thread of all of those types of work is that they're hard to get to. They're very hidden from us. But when we do read about them, I think the sort of familiar story, at least if we look, say to the prison section of the book, and which deals with the mental health ward of a particular prison in Florida that I investigated very closely. There are a lot of books about the mentally ill and people with severe mental illnesses and how we have let them down as a society since deinstitutionalization occurred. And as a result, we've had homelessness and really a lot of just incredible suffering because the community-based services that were hoped that advocates of deinstitutionalization hoped would be there, they've never been funded. And to the contrary, we cut funding for those things. But so the familiar story is of course about the people who suffer and namely people with severe illnesses, the criminalization of poverty and mental illness. But I wanted to write about the people who are, in a sense, caught in the middle of that. As you said, the workers. So I look at psychiatric aides and attendants who work in and run the mental health wards in prisons. And one of the reasons I wanted to highlight them is because when we read about the victims, the mentally ill themselves, it becomes easy for us to, you know, on the one hand, say this is terrible, and on the other hand, kind of fix the blame, if you will, on the easy culprits, which are, you know, the guards who say abused or mistreated mentally ill people behind bars. That's often what happens. But I wanted to complicate that narrative because, in fact, there's a problem with the fact that jails and prisons are our largest mental health institutions, and the people who do the work of the guards as well as the psychiatric aides are doing this in just about the last environment you would choose to provide humane care and treatment. So the book is really trying to pull back, and instead of fixing easy blame on the low-level workers who are in all of these roles, I try to look at how society at large is implicated and in a sense even served by the arrangements that lead to this dirty work happening like this.
You did such an amazing job of complicating these issues, especially in the section around prisons. Can you talk a little bit more about the power dynamics that you write about? Because you really look at the structural issues that brought us to this point. For example, you write, why should we have people working as drone operators instead of looking at the endless wars the United States has been engaged in? Afghanistan is a vivid, vivid example of that.
So if we look at the section on prisons, the book opens with the story of Harriet Kriskovsky, who, as I said, worked as a mental health aide at a prison called the Dade Correctional Institution in Florida, just south of Miami. And she went into it never having worked in a correctional institution before. She didn't know what to think. And she comes to learn that a lot of the patients entrusted to her care are being mistreated. They're being denied meals. They're being held in solitary cells. And most horrifying of all, some of them are being locked inside a scalding shower whose water flow was controlled from the outside by guards. And a man named Darren Rainey, a mentally ill incarcerated person, died in that shower. Harriet knew what happened. She learned of what happened from the nurses there, as did the rest of the staff, the mental health staff. Now, it is a duty, if you're a mental health employee and worker and professional, to protect your patients from harm. This isn't a difficult call if you see such a thing happening, say, in a hospital or a community mental health center. But this is a prison. And the people in charge of the prison were the guards. And they made it very clear, not just to Harriet, but to the other people who worked there, that they were in charge. And if they were defied, if someone, you know, reported what they did, they would pay the consequence by being left alone in the prison, by not having, you know, guards stand by the group sessions that they conducted sometimes or in the rec yard. And so Harriet, like most of her peers, kept silent about this. And, you know, one easy way to view her would be as an enabler and an accomplice. But of course, she's doing this job in a context that makes the kind of ethical action we would want and expect incredibly risky and difficult. And that part of it, you know, opens up and implicates the larger society. Why is this happening where it is? Why are mental health institutions our largest psychiatric care institutions? Now, just to complicate it a little further, the obvious villains in sort of as you read Harriet's story, the obvious villains are the guards who were doing this. And there is no question that the abuse at this prison was cruel, degrading, and criminal. And individuals needed to be held accountable for it. No criminal charges were brought, by the way. But even if criminal charges had been brought against the individuals involved, I make it very pointed case in the book that that's inadequate, because that's what we always do. We look to we blame the in a sense the bad apples at the bottom of the system who did something terrible, without thinking about what were the conditions that lead to such abuse. What about the warden? What about the Department of Corrections? What about the person in charge of the Department of Corrections, namely then Governor Rick Scott, who is now, by the way, a senator. So, you know, it's a broader circle of responsibility, and it leads in a way to how I define this term dirty work. I don't know if you want to hear a little more about how I distinguish that term from the expression that most people know.
Yes, we'll do that in a minute. But since you went so deep in the prison section of your book, let's just continue with this for a minute. So you told us about Harriet, and this is something that I'm sure a lot of people never think about, that these counselors that are there to actually help the prisoners, they can't speak up if they see violence happening, like the guards. And I should let people know that some of the things we're going to talk about might not be appropriate for children or might be triggering for some. the guards beating up the prisoners. I mean, some of the stuff you share is absolutely horrific. But if the counselors, as you say, write up a report, there might be backlash. Like, for example, in the case of Harriet, like you said, she was left in a room on her own, or, you know, maybe something worse. They could lose their job. So the obvious reaction is to say, well, why aren't we dealing with these guards? But then you tell the story of the guards and what they're dealing with.
That's right. And so, you know, again, not in any way to absolve
right,
the individuals who were responsible for Darren Rainey's death and for the suffering that Harriet learned about and was, and by the way, it caused her such suffering that she was later diagnosed with PTSD. Her hair fell out. She lost weight. It was really a traumatizing experience. But to get back to the guards. So in the following section of the book, I do go into the conditions of work for corrections officers, prison guards in Florida, and you know what one learns in that section is that you know these this the staff has been pared down in facility after facility. There is not a lot of funding for rehabilitative services and programming. There's not a lot of training for things like what to do when someone with severe mental illnesses is having a psychotic episode. There are patchwork programs here and there that have tried to divert people and address these things. But generally speaking, this is the way the system has been allowed to function. And so not surprisingly, and one former corrections officer, you know, who shared his own experience and also his diary with me when he was working in the system, he said, look, there are a lot of bullies. There are people in this profession who abuse and probably enjoy that abuse, and that's a terrible thing. But the people of Florida get what they pay for here. And this guy was a former military veteran, and you know, just as in you know wars where soldiers are sent off without a clear purpose and without protective equipment, you put guards in a situation where the staffing is low, the services are gone, they're not sure how to exactly control the situation, and they rely on brute force. And that's basically the lesson he learned, and he said it's the lesson that his peers learn. And so the system and the situation breeds this kind of us against them, warlike situation that leads to prisons and jails being rife with, not all of them, but so many, rife with brutality and violence. And I do believe that brutality and violence dehumanizes not just incarcerated people, but also the people who work in those settings. If you look at the life expectancy, the rates of suicide, hypertension, PTSD, all of these things are, to the extent they've been studied, are extremely disturbing and high among people who work in corrections, among guards. And that's not surprising when you look at the conditions and when you think about what happens to soldiers when they're exposed to violence. In fact, one corrections officer I interviewed had a son who did two tours of duty in Iraq, and he told me, I've seen more live combat than he has. So, you know, as a society, we have to kind of think about what are the conditions that enable and create this dirty work to happen and to happen under our watch. And to just throw one other element into all of this, the mental health services at that particular prison in Florida, as at all of them at the time, were privatized. So this was a for-profit enterprise. And what that does is it creates a, you know, a kind of penny counting or dollar counting in which the mental health staff, and this has been documented in various facilities, are aware of and made aware of the fact that costs have to be kept down. And in Florida, this resulted in people being given Tylenol for serious illnesses, people not being taken to the hospital when they should have been, all kinds of pressures that, again, have to do with our politics and the arrangements we've made. You know, that privatization which Rick Scott was a big proponent of, was sold as something that would save taxpayers money.
Again, this speaks to the power dynamics that you write about, pointing the fingers at the guards. And again, this is not to absolve the horrific things that guards have done that have been documented, but the system allows all of this to continue. And in the case of Harriet, for example, very little assistance or recourse for people like her.
Right. And so, you know, I think in the last year and a half, I think we've had this conversation, because of the pandemic, about what we've come to call essential workers, people who perform, deliver groceries, or pack groceries, drive buses, and have been exposed to physical risk, throughout this pandemic, and actually are disproportionately exposed to physical risk a lot of the time, even before the pandemic. But my book looks at a different kind of occupational hazard that has received a lot less attention. And what I mean is the psychic and emotional wounds that can come from doing a job that is demeaning, that is defiling, that makes a person feel like they can't actually bring their better selves forward. And in fact, they have to silence themselves when it comes to issues of ethics and, what kind of person they are. And, you know, again, this isn't every person who works in these jobs. Some people become numb. Some people take to it. But I think there's an injury as a society in all of those cases, because we're putting people in situations that are designed not to bring out, you know, their compassion, their care, and their dignity and pride, but the opposite of those things. And so a lot of the book is about these psychic wounds and a concept called moral injury, which it's familiar to some people who have read about veterans coming back from America's recent wars, but I think it applies much more broadly. And the idea is that when someone is duty bound to participate in or witness something that goes against their core values, it creates a lasting wound. And that wound goes somewhere, and it can be as debilitating and painful as something like PTSD, which is more associated with a kind of fear response. That these are some of the sort of themes that kept coming up as I was doing my research and my interviews.
Today, we're speaking with A.L. Press, an award-winning writer and journalist. His latest book is Dirty Work, Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. He tells the stories of a number of workers in this country who are doing, quote, dirty work, undocumented immigrants, for example, who man the kill floors of slaughterhouses. Now, we did hear a lot about these workers during the pandemic, but did we really hear about what they deal with on a regular basis? And what happens now? Will they still continue to get media coverage? If you have any questions for Eyal about his book and his work, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Did you want to respond to that, Eyal?
Well, I just think it's a great point because, the pandemic has, as I said, brought to the fore, and I say this at the outset of the book, it has in a sense, push some of these workers out of the shadows. But I fear that that's a very temporary thing. In other words, that, there's, you don't have to be a vegetarian to be troubled by our industrial food system and the kinds of things that go on in industrial slaughterhouses. And the experiences of the workers in those slaughterhouses did get some attention during the pandemic as we saw COVID outbreaks taking place, in part because there were ramifications for everyone else, the communities. But first of all, we did very little to protect those workers, it turns out. And in fact, as I describe in detail in one chapter of the book, there was far more focus on making sure consumers continued to have their unlimited supply of cheap meat and meat brought to their doorsteps conveniently than there was to the health and safety of those workers. But the second point is the one you raise, which is that, you know, at some point, the outbreaks will, and they already have, become less severe in these industrial, sites. And then they go back to the shadows. And yet the workers there continue to have to cope with the conditions.
You know, I really appreciate that you go so deep into the stories of the people you introduce us to. We could actually probably spend an hour on every chapter of your book, and we would love to have you back to go over what we cannot address today. But let's talk a little bit about Flor Martinez. You write that she grew up with her grandparents in north central Mexico in a small adobe home with no electricity and no running water. Her grandparents were poor, and her grandfather was a violent alcoholic. When he got drunk, he would fly into a rage and threaten to kill Flor's grandmother. Just give us kind of the shorter version of Flor Martinez's story, because it is just so important to hear about this.
Sure. And I should say, we began by saying this is a heavy book, and I know it is, but personally, you know, it is a book of stories, and the people who shared their stories with me have done so, with great courage, and their stories are really powerful and moving, and in my view, add a kind of light, to all of this, because, I hope so, at least, because, it's very, it's one thing to read about all of this in the abstract, but when you read about a particular person who goes through these experiences, I think it adds a humane dimension that's usually missing. So Flor, as you said, grew up in poverty. She comes to she eventually crosses the border, which is not after several attempts, and winds up in Texas. And then reunites with her father, and she ends up in a part of Texas where there is a poultry plant, and she starts working there. And the particular poultry plant I'm talking about is in Brazos County, not far from Texas A&M University, and it's owned by a company called Sanderson Farms. And anyway, Flor Martinez, by the way, that's not her real name, because workers in this industry are afraid. They often share stories only under pseudonyms. But anyway, Flor works at this plant and the slaughterhouse, and she suffers what you have heard a lot about, the repetitive strain injuries, the physical strain. This is a job where, because we've sped up the lines in these slaughterhouses so much, there is often 100% turnover at some of these plants. So in other words, people can work for a while, they get injured, then they just have to stop, and someone else comes and replaces them. And not coincidentally, an industry where a lot of immigrants and a lot of undocumented immigrants and refugees work. In some cases, they've been recruited to work in it. And this is because the conditions are so tough and so degrading and difficult that a lot of native-born Americans won't do it. And this is, you know, this wasn't true 40 years ago, but it is true in places today. And so at this poultry plant, there are a lot of physical injuries, and I recount them. And Flora is someone who suffers them severely in both her hands, actually. But it's the emotional experience that is even worse than this. And what I mean by that is, as she described it, having, you know, the supervisors yelling at the mostly women who were working on the lines, telling them to speed up and to get with it and not to slow down, and also yelling at them if they asked to take a break to go to the bathroom. And so there have been protests at this particular slaughterhouse where workers have spoke, former workers have spoken about needing to go to work with sanitary napkins or an extra pair of pants because they had to go to the bathroom while they kept working rather than during the very short break they were given when it was too crowded. And it's that sense of degradation, of feeling like you're an interchangeable part and that you're in a sense just, you know, you're good only to the extent you can keep up with this, but you're not a person who's part of this and whose feelings matter, that was most striking in the interviews I did, and that in Flor's case as well, eventually led her to feel like she had to stop working there. It wasn't the physical injuries; it was the blows to her spirit that ultimately were the most devastating, and that echoed in a lot of the other interviews I did. And you know, I think we can easily, again, condemn the companies that run these slaughterhouses the way they do, and they deserve the criticism they get because they profit from these conditions and because they are the ones who should be doing better by their workers. But the other factor behind all of this is an industrial food system that where consumers want, you know, their cheap meat at endless supply. And so that comes at a cost to people like Flor Martinez and to the other workers I interview.
Right, because you write about how the demand for chicken has increased drastically over the years. You also have a number in your book, which I'm trying to find here. You probably, maybe you know it. Just the number of restaurants, sort of fast food restaurants where you can get chicken now has also increased over the years.
Yes, I actually chose chicken because it's America's most popular meat. And it has grown exponentially, the consumption. This may change. I mean, the one of the things that I say at the outset of the book and that I really believe is that although dirty work is I call it, I refer to these workers as essential workers in a different way, because I think what they're doing sustains so many of our lifestyles and is connected to us and to the prevailing social order that we've tolerated and countenanced. But that is not set in stone. And these things can change. And there is a rising awareness of both what the workers go through and what the animals, what happens to the animals and what happens to the environment in the industrial food system. So there, as with prisons, as with pretty much any form of dirty work, it's not immutable. These are things that are shaped by our culture, our shared values, and to what extent we want to open our eyes and look at what we're countenancing.
And we should say that Sanderson Farms, which owned and operated the plant where Flor worked, is one of the world's largest poultry producers and the only Fortune 1000 corporation in Mississippi. The CEO was the highest paid in Mississippi, earning more than $10 million in 2017 and 2018. You also report that Flor unfortunately got COVID. Luckily, she survived. What's amazing is, how did you find Flor, Eyal, and are you still in touch with her?
I am. And, you know, the finding the people to write about was actually the most challenging part of the book, because as I said earlier, I didn't want to write a book that just presented abstract points. I wanted to write about the dilemmas and the experiences of the workers themselves, and to sort of broaden out from that into a larger story about America. And it takes a lot of time to find someone who not only has worked a job that can carry stigma and cause shame and guilt and moral injury, but who is ready to talk about those things. And this is actually really, really important, because I think when I talked about the psychic wounds and the emotional burdens of such work, you know, we've had a rising awareness in this country of inequality over the last decade. It's an extraordinary change. And I think that across the political spectrum, income inequality is something that people are aware of and that they generally decry and say isn't a good thing. But inequality doesn't always take material form. I am convinced, after talking to these workers and researching these industries and thinking about these dirty workers and what they do and what they go through, there's also something called moral inequality. So, you know, I began the book thinking about not just what kinds of jobs require you to, in a sense, dirty your hands, but who does those jobs? Who does them and who doesn't? And the one thing I can say about all of the examples I went into in depth is that people with privilege and power don't do them. The more privileged you are, the more likely you are to be distant from this kind of work. Whereas if you have fewer choices and opportunities, less education, come from an area of the country where it's just less difficult to find a good paying job that doesn't entail this kind of thing, you're more likely to wind up doing this. And so this is also very much a book about inequality, but inequality seen through a slightly different lens, a moral lens as well as a material one.
Al, you quote so many people in the book. You cite also different books that made a huge difference, like Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, for example. And I just wonder, in today's world, the political climate, money in politics, massive inequality, what do you think it will take to actually change this? Because as you say, if you stopped people on the street, no one would support people working in these factories having to come to work wearing diapers because they cannot go to the bathroom in a chicken slaughterhouse. If you would tell people what's really going on in prisons, they would oppose this. I mean, a lot of people are easy to say, especially, I mean, I've seen this on media boards in the Bay Area with crime, you know, find this person and throw them in jail. If they had a mental illness and you were really able to talk to them about what's going on here, a lot of people oppose this. So what does it take to change this? Because it's out there. I mean, it's in your book. We've got videos of this, reports from Human Rights Watch, for example, that you cite in your book.
Mm-hmm. So this is another critical point. I did say earlier that all of the examples I chose and a lot of the dirty work in America is concealed. In other words, it takes place in facilities and institutions that the public doesn't have access to. On the one level, you could say, well, okay, if there were, you know, more exposure, it would change. But I don't know that it's that simple, because I think there's something else we lack. And that's what I call and refer to at various points as the will to know. That there's a kind of apathy. And that phrase, by the way, is not mine. It comes from a sociologist named Everett Hughes. And as I was thinking about, you know, people whose jobs require them to kind of do these thankless, ethically defiling things, I came across an essay that Hughes wrote actually in 1962. And the title of the essay is called Good People and Dirty Work. And it really struck me that just the title. Now, Hughes wrote the essay based on conversations he'd had in post-war Germany after World War II. And he went there to talk to the people he'd known before the war, the intellectuals, the professionals, architects, what he called good people. These were not people who joined the Nazi party. These were not people who were, supporters of Adolf Hitler. There was obviously a great deal of discomfort to sort of deal with the whole subject of what had happened during the war. But Hughes started bringing it up. And what he heard in one dinner or visit he had to an architect's studio that I begin the book with, the architect said to him, you know, listen, I'm ashamed for my country and my people whenever I think about it. He's referring to the genocide that the Nazis carried out, the persecution of the Jews that preceded it and of other groups. He says, I'm ashamed for my people whenever I think about it. But then he goes on to say, but you know, the Jews, they were a problem and something had to be done about them. I'm not saying, and he sort of says, he equivocates. I'm not saying what the Nazis did was right, but there was a problem and it had to be taken care of or solved in some way. And Hughes extrapolates from these conversations, and hence the title, Good People and Dirty Work, that the people who do the dirty work, who carried out the atrocities in Nazi Germany, were not entirely disconnected from the good people who refrained from asking too many questions. Indeed, the dirty workers were agents of good people who just kind of averted their eyes and didn't want to, think too much about it, because on some level, they didn't entirely disagree. And so that essay, now you read that essay and think, okay, that's fine. It applies to Nazi Germany, but what an extreme case. That has nothing to do with the United States. But Hughes was an American sociologist, and actually his profession is one in which you look for patterns that play out in all societies. And indeed, he said this dynamic exists in every society, and in fact is arguably even more salient in a democracy like the United States than in a dictatorship like Nazi Germany. Because here, good people can vote. Good people can get on the street and protest. They can go and say, you know, we won't tolerate this. This can't be done in our name. In a dictatorship, you do those things at risk to your life. So, you know, he was very pointed about the fact that he wrote this essay for North Americans, thinking about the dangers in our own midst. That's how he put it. And that's the kind of that's the starting point for my book. I say, okay, well, let's revisit these questions. What kind of dirty work is done in our name? You know, how much of this work has what Hughes called a tacit mandate, a kind of unconscious mandate from society, a society that just doesn't really want to hear too much about it and is happy to have it go on in the shadows. So that's your point about what it would take. You know, I'm not an advocate. I'm a writer. But I think the first thing it takes is telling the stories of the people who are caught up in these worlds, and hopefully starting a conversation about whether we want these things done in our name.
Reading the book, Eyal, I was thinking about this because we do a lot of shows about these issues, and sometimes people write in and say, I didn't have anything to offer, but just thank you for bringing these voices out. And I do wonder, you know, if you look at the political climate right now with gerrymandering, money in politics, the Electoral College, in many ways, what we have, I would hope, is not what the people actually want. So, and it has been proven that in many states, these politicians are passing laws that the people do not want, but they're gerrymandered and they just can't do anything about it. So that adds a little more, just something else to the conversation that I think about a lot. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, you're right. When I use the term democracy to describe the United States, you know, I think we have a very troubled democracy. We have a democracy in which, you know, to me at least, it appears that the will and the values of ordinary people and their concerns are twisted so far from the actual policies that we have, that in a sense, you're right to ask the question, how different is this? On the other hand, I think that, you know, despair and hopelessness in the face of all of this is not warranted. Just to go back to the first section of my book, Behind the Walls, Prisons, I started with that in part because, and I say this in the book, you know, 10, 15 years ago, there really wasn't much talk about mass incarceration. And it wasn't just Republicans who supported the tough on crime policies that created the world's largest prison system. Let's stop to appreciate that. The world's largest prison system. It wasn't just Republicans. It was also Democrats. It was also Bill Clinton's crime bill. It was also a lot of liberals who feared being depicted as soft on crime, who said, yeah, we got to toughen up and ramp up these mandatory minimum sentences. There's been a pretty extraordinary shift in a decade to kind of really open up, both because it's so costly, but also because I think more and more Americans realize it's enormously inhumane and it's racist. It is a racial caste system, that, you know, in some sense, disturbingly echoes and mirrors what happened in the Jim Crow South, as scholars like Michelle Alexander have argued. And so, you know, there's been a rising awareness of that. And so, there has been, and there is, I think, an openness to the stories I tell in this book, which also show how far we have to go. And, you know, one of the things I say in the book is that we have talked a lot about reducing the prison population. We don't talk a lot about the conditions inside. And there are still 2 million people who are confined in jails and prisons in this country. There are countless more who cycle through the system. And the mentally ill, to me, just dramatize how wasteful and inhumane this is in every sense. Who really gains from this, other than maybe those for-profit companies that can hand out, you know, bonuses to executives and increase their shareholder ratings? Who really benefits from a society that, you know, John F. Kennedy said back, this was back in the 1960s, early 60s, we need to shut down our asylums because the coldness of custodial care needs to be replaced by community services. Well, we got rid of the asylums, but now we have a form of custodial care that is even worse and that is crueler. And I do think there is an openness to thinking about why is this, and should it happen? But again, it's not my job to tell people how to vote, what to think. It is my job to tell stories and to try to analyze and hopefully explain why the things that are happening are happening.
A.L. Press is author of the new book, Dirty Work, Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. And let's hear from Ernie in San Francisco. Hi, Ernie. Are you still there? Thanks for holding.
Yes. Hey, yeah, fantastic guest and a great show today. Question two is do any of these poultry producers and beef producers and so forth, do they use those, quote, surprise ICE raids to, I guess, I don't know, to get rid of employees, or in some way kind of use that as some sort of, I don't know, part of their business plan to cycle illegals through and send them, you know, send them away?
That's a great question. Can I take it on?
Please, yes.
Thank you, Ernie, for asking that. And, you know, I think that, you know, under President Trump, former President Trump, the fear of such raids, and I describe one that took place in Tennessee that kind of echoed across the industry among workers. The fear was enormous, to the point that, so I mentioned that I wrote about a plant in Texas. There was another state I went to because I had some good leads, and I thought I'd interview the workers there. Not a single one would talk to me, not even with a pseudonym, not even with a pseudonym. And why was that? Because of fear that if their name appeared in a paper, suddenly their immigration status might be challenged. And you know, I will say that the companies, you know, they'll tell you, we check people's papers, we don't hire undocumented people, and you know, we're careful about this. But As scholars like Angela Stuzzi, an anthropologist, and others have found, there's kind of a double game with that. So on the one hand, it's, you know, they check. On the other hand, it's not a bad thing to have a frightened workforce that can be cowed into doing an injurious, difficult, degrading job. Because if you're scared to talk about the conditions of work, who's going to stand up in that situation? So the answer is, yeah, there's that's an enormous factor in all of this.
Thank you for that call. I mean, you do quote people in your book, undocumented people who say, do I want to put up with this? Of course not, but I have a family to feed.
Right. And that gets back to the inequality theme, that, you know, these are jobs of last resort for people who have a lot of choices, but for the people doing them, they're often a lifeline. And by the way, not all of these jobs result in impoverishment. Sometimes this is the one job a person can find that, you know, pays a little more than the minimum wage, or might come with benefits, which is the case for some prison guards. But there's a cost to that, right? It's the sort of all the other things that come with such a job that explain why people who have real choices and privilege don't do them. And I should say something, since I know I'm talking to an audience in San Francisco, maybe I should say something about the sort of upper class, or rather the high status jobs that many people think of as ethically troubling, and why I distinguish them from the kinds of jobs we've been talking about. I don't know if you want me to say something about
that. Sure, please.
Sure. So, you know, I do, there is a chapter in the book called Dirty Tech. And I talk about the fact that a lot of people in the tech world, software engineers and computer programmers, in the last few years have kind of started to say, hey, wait a minute. You know, I thought I was working in this really ethical industry, but we design spyware. Or we sell, you know, search engines to China that are used to, you know, that are censored. So if you put the word protest in, the government might find out. And there's been this kind of bubbling up of protest within the technology sector. And I do say from the outset of the book that in technology and banking, of course you have a lot of what some people would say is dirty work. But I distinguish it because in the case of software engineers and bankers, as dirtying as such work can be, these are also workers who have a much more of an ability to make their voices heard in our society. They have more financial resources to switch careers. They have skills that enable them, if they're put in an uncomfortable situation, they can say, you know what? I don't want to do this. I'll get another job. And in fact, I write about Jack Paulson, who used to work at Google, and very principled employee. He found out that there was a project just like the one I described, where a Google search in China was going to be sort of melded with the Great Firewall so that it would be effectively censoring. And he was appalled by this. And so he did something that a person with some agency in such a situation can do, which is he exited. Well, first he used his voice. He complained internally. He wasn't satisfied with what was told to him. And so he left. That took courage. It was a principled thing to do. But it is the kind of act that someone, you know, with advanced degrees and high-tech skills can do with less fear than an undocumented immigrant for obvious reasons in a poultry plant, or someone like Harriet Kraskowski, who was working in the prison I mentioned. Mm-hmm. And with bankers too, you know, that there was, after the 2008 financial crash, a lot of people said, oh, this is a dirty industry. But it was notable what the bankers said in response. They didn't hang their heads for the most part. They said, this is outrageous that the government is trying to regulate us. You know, we bring profits to this country. We are, you know, the elite. We are the successful. And I do think that in this society, success confers moral virtue. And so far from ashamed, they were indignant and, you know, saying Congress doesn't have any place in telling us how to do our business. So I do think that the class dynamics matter a lot.
We have an email from Sarah who writes, thank you so much for covering this book. I've read about slaughterhouses and I've worked with the mentally ill in jails, so I'm aware of these situations, but they definitely need more publicity. Have you thought about approaching Netflix to turn your book into a several episode docuseries?
Well, I don't know that there are many writers who don't have such fleeting thoughts on occasion as they're doing the difficult work of interviews and research and writing. But I'll leave that decision to others. I don't have, you know, any particular experience in those fields. But, you know, there certainly are stories that could be dramatized and told to kind of illuminate these dynamics.
She also writes, regarding the slaughterhouses, in the past, PETA would post videos from inside factory farms and slaughterhouses, and after these videos became public, didn't Congress pass laws making it illegal to video inside factory farms and slaughterhouses?
That's absolutely right. So one of the things, again, this issue of concealment is central. And, you know, the keeping people from seeing these things is a huge barrier. And I should say, there's one section in my book, actually in the slaughterhouse section, where there's an advocate I write about who is trying to get 60 Minutes to do something, or maybe it's 2020. I think it's 2020, trying to get them to do something about this particular slaughterhouse that's really terrible. And they tell her, you know, this is too violent. Mm. And meanwhile, she's at her hotel one night flicking through the channels, and it's all violence. You know, it's violence on the news, violence in dramas, violence this, violence that, but involving people. And how often have you actually seen the inside of a slaughterhouse even dramatized on TV in this country? Not very often.
Imagine if we did. I also just wanted to note, I have seen, when you talk about changes, Eyal, it's such a good point, because I have seen major changes among the animal rights movement. Whereas it used to be the focus was on the animal and the violence against the animals, but that is really changing. So many animal rights groups are now really advocating for the animals and the workers. And that has started in the past couple of years. And it really, I think, is because the animal rights movement has become far more diverse.
Well, that's crucial and important and good for them, because it is one of the points I make, because I heard it from some of these workers, you know, who felt like consumers care so much more about what happened to the chicken, you know, that there's no antibiotics, there's no hormones, there's no this, there's that. What about the workers? There's nothing on the labels they buy to talk about that. So good for those who are changing that.
Yeah. Final thoughts, Eyal, your hopes for this book. Again, I love that you say we have to tell these stories and humanize what is often numbers. I think it's so important, and thank you for that.
Thank you. I guess my final thought is just for those out there who have been listening and who are really troubled by these kinds of things, I think that there's an obligation, a sort of moral obligation we all have, to suspend judgment for just a minute before kind of blaming the direct participants. It's not that they're blameless. They often do carry responsibility. They often are to blame in the case of those guards. But we don't think enough about the structures and systems that have created these conditions. And we have to ask ourselves, how differently would we act in that situation? So that's kind of my closing thought.
Eyal Press is an award-winning writer and journalist. He's the author of many books. His most recent is Dirty Work, Essential Jobs, and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. And you can find more about his work at yourcallradio.org. Eyal, thank you so much for joining us, and we'd love to have you back, because unfortunately we didn't have time to talk about your section on drone operators, but we'd love to have you back to talk more about that.
I'd love to do that. So great. Look forward to future conversations. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show, and Joanne Marr, our engineer. Thank you. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can listen to past shows there. Be sure to sign up for our podcast. You can also leave us a review, and you can sign up for Twitter @yourcallradio. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.